Hello, and welcome to Ipsy Dixit, a podcast on legal scholarship. I'm your host, Luce Nguyen, a student at Oberlin College and co-founder of the Oberlin Policy Research Institute, an undergraduate public policy organization based at Oberlin College. My guest today is Claudia Haupt, Associate Professor of Law and Political Science at the Northeastern University School of Law. We will discuss her article, Professional Speech, in the Yale Law Journal, and her two successive articles, Professional Speech in the Content Neutrality Trap and The Limits of Professional Speech, published in the Yale Law Journal Forum. Welcome, Professor Haupt.
Hi, Luce. Thanks for having me on.
So let's go over the basics of why you wrote these articles and what the crux of your argument is.
Sure. So the kind of starting point was that, we have this idea of a professional client relationship, and we have these sort of ideas of what speech within a professional client relationship does. So you go to your doctor or your lawyer to get advice that you need in order to make important decisions about, things in your life that you don't have the necessary expertise, but that's what your professionals are there for. So we have these ideas that we get good advice. It's ensured that we get advice if we go to a licensed professional. If they give us bad advice, then there's malpractice liability at the back end. We know that there's this framework around professional advice giving. What we don't know really is why all of that is consistent with the First Amendment. So everybody agrees that it's perfectly fine to have things like professional malpractice liability or informed consent requirements. But why that is consistent with the First Amendment, I thought needed a little bit of theoretical work. And so I set out to kind of, figure out why the regimes we have are the way they are, and whether that's consistent with our understanding of the First Amendment. And really what my argument is that it's a specific type of speech that happens with a professional and a client. And what it's really focused on is knowledge. So the idea that professionals are not speaking their mind as you would sort of in public discourse, in other contexts, that's really not the core of what speech between a professional and a client does. And from that flow all of these doctrinal implications that make professional speech look different than other types of speech.
So you suggest in your paper that the learned professions, law, medicine, dentistry, etc., should be thought of as knowledge communities. Can you explain what you mean by a knowledge community?
Sure. So the idea of a knowledge community is really that there's such a thing as disciplinary knowledge or professional knowledge that then flows from this, body of insights that are generated within the discourse of a profession to the individual client. So it's not so much things that a professional wants to say or opinions that a professional has, but it's really connecting the professional as sort of the conduit of professional insight to the client. And there is kind of a marketplace within the profession. So if you want to talk about First Amendment theories that would support protection of professional speech, the marketplace of ideas is one of the main theories that we have. And the way that it works within the profession is that you have agreed upon ways of knowing and reasoning. And professionals within the profession are bound together by these ways of knowing and reasoning. And as long as you operate on this shared basis, you're a member of that profession. And the idea really is that this distinguishes the speech of professionals within a professional client relationship from the speech of, say, a professional on TV, right? Imagine you're a doctor who's hosting a TV program and you're giving advice there. So that really makes it different, because then you're not constrained by the legal framework that makes the professional client relationship distinctive.
So when you talk of internal marketplaces within professional communities, can you give some examples and some explanations of that kind of internal marketplace?
Sure. So professional knowledge is not monolithic, right? You might think about different opinions that you can get by going to different doctors. The way that I would delineate whether they're still within this internal marketplace of the profession is whether they follow the same types of knowing and reasoning. So imagine you go to the doctor, they have different interpretations of the same underlying professional knowledge. And if you look at it from sort of the flip side of the tort regime, that's something that we know from a doctrine called two schools of thought or respectable minority doctrine, which means that you can still pass the professional standard, which is what governs in tort the tort of malpractice, right? But there's a range of acceptable opinions, but there's also a universe of just stuff that's wrong. So if I have, for example, a political or a philosophical disagreement with my profession, or if I just use data that's inaccurate and give advice based on that, I place myself outside of this discourse of the profession, which I called the marketplace that's internal to the profession. Now, as long as we're talking about the marketplace metaphor, it's also important to point out that it's a really bad way of thinking about the professional client relationship, because there we're not subjecting professional knowledge to kind of the competition of the market, right? There is no market, there is no contestation between the professional and the client. So it's really a limited way in which the marketplace metaphor works in the professional speech context.
So in your paper, you criticize scholars who analogize professional speech to commercial speech. I think of the quote by Benjamin Cardozo in Berkey versus Third Avenue Railway Company, that metaphors and law are to be narrowly watched, for starting as devices to liberate thought, they often end by enslaving it. In your opinion, how does the analogy of professional speech versus commercial speech fail as a device to understand professional speech and First Amendment implications of professional speech?
You know, I think there are really two quibbles that I have with the commercial speech analogy. One is this idea of, you know, going back to our discussion of the knowledge communities, there is no body of knowledge that is conveyed between the speaker, a commercial speaker, and a listener, other than sort of information about the product and those types of things. So I think the quality, this is a qualitative argument about what it is that is conveyed. The other thing, and maybe even the larger issue I have with this, and what goes with that, just to finish that thought, what goes with that is the flip side of malpractice liability, which draws on exactly the same body of knowledge that I would say is part of protected professional advice. Now, the other thing, there's a move that we've seen increasingly in commercial speech, which actually started out as listener-oriented. So this was about informing marketplace participants. Now, as long as we have a listener focus, I would say it's a much better analogy to professional speech. But over the years, the court has quite radically moved away from this listener focus, and now it's all about the speaker in commercial speech. And as I said, the professional speaker is not speaking because they want to sort of speak their mind. But they're really in a listener focused professional client relationship, because remember that the primary reason that the client seeks out the professional's advice, and the primary reason that they're talking in this professional client relationship in the first place is because the listener needs certain expertise that they lack, but need in order to make important decisions. So it is really a listener centric sort of relationship. And so that's the other reason that I think that the commercial speech analogy fails.
So at the heart of all the discussion of professional speech is this idea of information asymmetry, and the idea that professionals are supposed to be representing the common knowledge of their professional knowledge networks. Can you expand on that?
Sure. So the importance of that really is that other than in or contrary to public discourse as we understand it, as sort of every opinion counts the same way, everybody gets to say whatever they want, which you know, if you look at it from the perspective of sort of democratic theory, that's really the way it should be. In the professional client relationship, the value of that relationship, the context, really depends on whether the information conveyed, and I'm even hesitant to call it information because really knowledge, I think, is a specific type of information. Whether that is, professional expertise, and if it's not reliable and accurate and comprehensive, then from the client's or from the patient's perspective, the value of that exchange goes away.
So something that you touched on earlier was the idea of, democratic theory and the importance of democratic self-governance. Mm-hmm. In your paper, you note that, there has been an emphasis on the role of lawyers and democratic self-government, but there can also be an argument made that other professionals can contribute towards the knowledge as essential for a democratic polity to completely understand it. Where does First Amendment protections play into this idea of democratic self-governance interests?
So, I mean, if you look at the larger idea of democratic self-governance, it really applies quite straightforwardly to public discourse. And that is this idea that everybody gets to participate in society evenly, and we don't distinguish based on viewpoint or content of speech. If you try to move that into the realm of professional speech, it gets a little trickier because, like I said earlier, there's no subjecting the advice of a professional to kind of this democratic competition of ideas with the client. And if you want to use it in terms of informing a decision that you can then transform into policy, I think it might be a little more attenuated, but you can still see how good professional advice given sort of on a one-on-one basis would increase the knowledge more broadly that policy decisions might be made on. It's really sort of a rising tide argument because, all of the knowledge that is taken even on an individual basis then flows back into the decision-making process.
So the role of professionals and professional knowledge communities within that kind of framework would be what exactly?
So within that framework, what you rely on is accurate advice on a one-on-one basis that would then allow that expertise flows from the profession through this advice-giving relationship to the client. And the client then you know, in aggregate, the clients or the patients, right, in aggregate, then are better informed as a result of their interaction with professionals. So this is, you know, this is basically extrapolating. This is not the classic sort of, I'm going to the doctor, I'm going to the lawyer to solve this one specific problem. This is going a step further. Now that I know what type of advice I got to solve this one specific problem, I'm going to take that as an increase in my knowledge on this one point, and I can make decisions based on that going forward.
So if professional speech is based upon this one-on-one interaction between practitioners and their clients, mm-hmm. What role does, you know, state regulation of professional licensure, of certain standards of maintaining professional ethics play into First Amendment protections of professional speech?
So that's a really interesting question, because that's another one of those areas that we haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about and that have just more recently come into focus. So there are actually a number of ongoing First Amendment challenges to professional licensing regimes. And in areas outside of the professional context, it might actually make sense to think of this as, you know, an impermissible prior restraint on speech. If you have to get a license to speak first, that usually doesn't work. In the professional context, it's different. And this is one of those doctrinal features that distinguishes the area of professional speech. So if we're trying to regulate, or if you're trying to ensure a certain level of competence of your professional, in order to give good advice, right? The interests actually align between professional licensing, so sort of an ex ante readable signifier of expertise, really. This is a competent person you're going to, not a quack who will give you terrible advice. And as a result, cause potentially major injuries. If you think about it that way, if you think about it as sort of ensuring knowledge of the professional, then the interests underlying professional licensing and the interests underlying professional speech actually are the same. So I would argue that it actually makes very little sense to use the First Amendment as a sword, so to speak, to challenge professional licensing regimes, because they really have the same goal.
So something that has been under recent criticism in many states has been professional licensing regimes of beauticians and hair barbers. Mm-hmm. Something I think of is Shoshana Weissman's work with the R Street Institute, and some of the work that's been happening out of Arizona recently to deregulate certain regulatory regimes of mm-hmm. hair barbers and et cetera. Does the inherent regulation of these of the beauticians and barbers make them professionals under the law, or is this a case of overregulation that shouldn't be entitling these people to a form of professional speech?
So as a sort of first step, I want to say that I absolutely agree that there may be very good reasons to rethink currently existing professional licensing regimes. It's just not a First Amendment problem. Now, on the one hand, you know, we have to distinguish among different occupations, and there it could get a little tricky. The more you move away from the advice-giving, paradigmatic lawyer and doctor examples. So the beautician, the florists, I think, you know, there the First Amendment claim is weaker, because what they're doing is not actually this advice-giving activity that I talked about in connection with doctors and lawyers. it gets more tricky when you move to tour guides, for example, right? So there are cases in New Orleans and in DC fairly prominently about tour guide licensing. And what they're doing is actually speech. Now, the question is that the type of professional knowledge that doctors and lawyers have, or is that something that you could also get from, you know, maps or guidebooks? And does that make a difference? So I think that's when it gets trickier.
State regulations, as you say, establish the boundaries of a professional client discourse without directly affecting its content. So how does this play out when we're talking about, you know, the kinds of discussions that happen between a lawyer and their client or a doctor and their patient?
So, I mean, I think the most obvious one we just talked about, which is they can still regulate licensing, right? That doesn't mean that the state actually regulates what can be said between a professional and a client. And that's really the important distinction between regulation of the professions and regulation of professional speech. So if you say you need a certain level of expertise in order to be licensed, what you're really doing as the state is, you know, deferring to the professional standard, which is also what the tort regime does. So whether you give advice consistent with the insights of the profession is for the professional knowledge community to decide, not for the state. And we've increasingly seen states becoming active in trying to tell professionals what to say to their clients. And so that's really where it becomes a problematic kind of crossover from regulation of the professions, which is perfectly fine, to regulation of professional speech. So if you, for example, take the case of the Florida statute that prohibited doctors from asking their patients about gun ownership as a matter of course, there the professional consensus was, no, we should ask for various reasons, but the state said, we don't want you to ask. So that is when you get into regulation of professional speech in the sense that the state is trying to tell professionals what to say or prohibits them from asking certain questions.
So is this the appropriate area that the proverbial First Amendment sword should be used to protect professional speech?
I think so. And the reason is that we're trying to protect expertise. Now, you can think of sort of juxtaposing state regulation or state legislation, rather, that enshrines a professional standard, that codifies a professional standard, and one that contradicts the professional standard. So, you know, if you think about, for example, the conversion therapy legislation in California and New Jersey, was upheld by the Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit, respectively. If you contrast that with the 11th Circuit case in the Florida gun laws, right? So that was the one I just talked about. The conversion therapy legislation codifies professional insights. The Florida case does exactly the opposite. There, the legislature says you cannot act in accordance with professional insights. So really, state activity in this area becomes problematic when it contradicts professional knowledge. And there, I think the First Amendment should protect the professional from essentially giving bad advice to the client.
So in an article based upon that case in Florida, Wolschlager versus Governor of Florida, mm-hmm. you write that, you know, content neutrality should be rejected in the professional speech context. What does that mean in terms of the Florida gun law case and overall towards your argument of professional speech and the First Amendment?
Yeah, so we've seen this this expansion of content neutrality, this principle of content neutrality across all areas of the First Amendment. It started, or you know, one of the big landmark cases in this area is Reed against Town of Gilbert, and this it's about a municipal sign ordinance, and it looked like this really innocuous case, but it turns out that it aggressively expands content neutrality across the First Amendment. So The reason that I think that makes very little sense in the professional context is that the value of professional speech depends on its content. And in fact, the idea of imposing malpractice liability for bad advice would go away if we actually took that content neutrality paradigm as seriously as perhaps Reed might suggest. And as Wolschlager suggests. So the court, what happened in Wolschlager was that they actually decided the case based on content neutrality. But, you know, I think that that is actually the wrong way to think about this. Because what we're going for is not really whether something is content neutral, but whether the content is according to professional insights. So what we're looking for is how well does the state legislation track professional knowledge? And that's not content neutral by any means.
So you'd prefer the courts to take up a analysis based on the professional standards existing at the time of the case?
Which is exactly what they're also doing in tort law. So this would be thinking about First Amendment protection for professional speech and liability for professional malpractice as sort of two sides of the same coin. Yes.
So moving on to your article, The Limits of Professional Speech, a relatively recent Supreme Court decision, National Institute of Family Life and Advocates versus Becerra, NIFLA, was decided recently with talking about crisis pregnancy centers, which provide anti-abortion counseling, quote, behind a facade of reproductive health care and often deceive prospective clients by appearing to be typical health care providers. How does this tie into your idea of how we should regulate professional speech under the First Amendment?
So what's interesting about the NIFLA case is that the Ninth Circuit originally upheld these disclosures. It was about disclosures at crisis pregnancy centers, as you said. And the Ninth Circuit originally upheld these disclosures as professional speech. What I think is important, though, is that, you know, we talked about how professional speech is distinctive and how professional speech is different from speech in public discourse and sort of has these doctrinal quirks that we don't see elsewhere in the First Amendment. And I think what's really important is that we understand this in a very narrow way, only as it relates to the professional-client relationship and professional advice given within that professional-client relationship. And so I think we should be very careful to expand the idea of professional speech beyond this very core that protects expertise and the flow of expertise. Now, if you look at the disclosures in the NIFLA case, they didn't convey expertise. They conveyed information about laws as they existed in California. They did not convey the knowledge of, you know, the knowledge community through the conduit of the individual professional to the client. And so that's why I think this was wrong of the Ninth Circuit to decide this on professional speech grounds. Now, what then happened was that Justice Thomas in NIFLA said, well, there is no such thing as professional speech. We've never recognized a separate category of speech that's called professional speech. I would argue with that in the sense that they've never called anything professional speech, but they've, you know, pretty consistently recognized that there are doctrinal peculiarities in this type of speech. So even if they don't want to call it that, it does exist sort of as a descriptive matter, as doctrinally distinctive. And in fact, in the NIFLA opinion, Justice Thomas readily concedes that, of course, malpractice liability is perfectly fine, and informed consent regimes are also perfectly fine. So despite the fact that, you know, he hesitates to accept that professional speech is a distinctive category and gives it, does not want to give it that label. He does accept that it is, in fact, distinctive as a doctrinal matter.
So regarding the entire issue of professional speech and, you know, these crisis pregnancy centers, this seems like an area rife for legal interpretation, because these are organizations that aren't following the accepted medical standards. How should the law regulate them from the professional speech aspect and from other aspects not regarding professional speech? How do you think that the law should be approaching difficult issues like crisis pregnancy centers, or like in the other case about conversion therapy for homosexuals?
So what I think is that one of them concerns professional knowledge and the other one doesn't, right? So if the state of California, for example, thinks that it's a good idea to codify the professional standard prohibiting conversion therapy, then that's fine. This is about, a profession, and this is codifying a professional standard. Now, we might argue about whether it's a good idea for the state to get involved at all, because, you know, that professional standards may change over time. And so you would have to find some mechanism to adopt state legislation to match the professional insights. On the other hand, again, as I said, we do that in tort law as well, where it's not codified, of course. But we also take this dynamic of the development of professional knowledge in account there. Now, the difference between the conversion therapy example and the crisis pregnancy center example is that you do not, as you said, you do not get professional advice at crisis pregnancy centers. So as far as I'm concerned, this should not be analyzed. Speech at crisis pregnancy centers should not be analyzed, or I should say the types of disclosures that were an issue at crisis pregnancy centers in the NIFLA case should not be analyzed under a professional speech framework, because they did not convey any type of expertise. If a staff member at a crisis pregnancy center sort of holds themselves out as a professional, they should, you know, in order to protect the client, because that's really, or the, you know, I hesitate to say patient in that context, because as we said, this is not a professional setting. But if they hold themselves out as giving professional advice, they should be held to the professional standard. And there's, you know, very little that suggests to me that they would meet that standard. But for the types of disclosures that were at issue in the NIFLA case, the professional speech framework should not apply.
So in general, your opinion on state interference on professional speech is one of general non-interference. Would that be the correct read of your scholarship?
I think not. Well, non-interference on the content of advice, with the understanding that professional knowledge is not monolithic and is dynamic over time, I also don't mind codification of professional insights. The real problem is when the state tries to legislate in a way that contradicts professional knowledge. And it's really that contradiction of professional knowledge that I think the First Amendment should provide a barrier against, if you know, in the interest of both the profession, the professional, and also, most importantly, of the client or patient who seeks the professional's advice.
So what would you like state legislators, for district courts and the Supreme Court, to take away from this framework of professional speech that you advocate?
Well, I mean, for one, the understanding that professional speech is distinctive, whether you want to call it professional speech or not, it is governed by a set of doctrinal features that distinguishes it from other types of speech. What we're mainly concerned about is that the client or patient receives accurate, reliable, comprehensive advice in accordance with the insights of the profession. If that's the takeaway, then I think I'm pretty happy with that.
All right. Well, thank you, Professor Haupt, for coming on the Ipsy Dixit Legal Podcast.
Thank you so much.
Will Rogers used to say, "We're all ignorant, only about different things." This is more than funny. It is, of course, perfectly true. It's impossible for one person to know everything there is to know about any single thing. For example, the wisest physician in the world cannot know all there is to know about medicine. Therefore, he has areas of ignorance even in his own specialty. Outside of his specialty, he must remain a babe in the woods as far as knowledge is concerned. There is nothing about which everything is known. Whenever you hear someone say, "I know all about that," he's using a figure of speech, or he's a fool. Not one human being on Earth knows all there is to know about anything. Agreed? All right, then. We're all ignorant, painfully so. Once a man or woman can admit this, there's a real chance for him or her in the world. Starting then from this premise, it then becomes a matter of degrees, tiny, almost infinitesimal degrees of knowledge that makes the difference between people. So remember this. The area and degree of a person's ignorance will determine his place in the world. The wisest physician in the world is ignorant even in his specialty, but less ignorant than all the rest of the physicians.